determine what the future will bring, and I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, but please do not put in a call. That is, please do not put in a call unless we ask for calls, because we have with us on the line our good friend, Dr. Dennis Cuddy. Dennis, thank you so very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what are we going to cover today? Are we going to cover your latest article up there on the newswithviews.com?
Sure, we could do that.
Now, what would you like to talk about?
Well, that one's fine, or any of the current events that are going on. I try in this series, Mental Health, Education, and Social Control, to cover various subjects. In each case, something about mental health, something about education, and something about social control. But it often coincides with various events, whether it's the current hot topic is the hearings about the new nominee for the Central Intelligence Agency's director, and there's sort of this banter back and forth. It seems like a dog and pony show going on, where Senator Levin says, "Well, are you concerned about privacy?" And he says, "Oh, yes, that's a top concern." Of course, the word "concerned" is meaningless, because you can be concerned about garbage collection tomorrow, but that doesn't mean you can do anything about it or will do anything about it. And so they go through the motions, and they're pretty much going to do what they're going to do anyway. And the fact that a lot of secret things have been going on regarding our private communications just seems to not matter too much. And it's, like I said, it's basically, I think, a dog and pony show. He'll probably could be confirmed. There's a lot of huffing and puffing, but in the end, they pretty much go forward with their agenda.
All right, fine. Of course, I think it's important for our listeners to understand this whole issue that they're bringing up about privacy. My goodness, do you know that the NSA is collecting all lists of all the telephone calls we've ever made? Isn't that terrible? This has been going on for 20 years. This is not a new issue at all. This is symbolism over substance. They're making a lot of fuss about it. They're trying to get people to say, well, gee, in the name of fighting Osama bin Laden, maybe we better just give NSA the ability to do these things. After all, you don't want to support the terrorists, do you? They've been doing this, and they're not interested in the terrorists at all. They're not even trying to get Osama bin Laden, because, they obviously know something we don't know, and if there's really a war on terrorism, why won't they allow racial profiling on airplanes? Why won't they seal our borders? And why have there been no major attacks in the United States for over 4 years if we're really involved in this war against these terrible terrorists? Or maybe nothing is as it appears to be. What are your thoughts on that?
In fact, on this program before, we've talked about they came to us for these warrantless searches. Under the guise, well, we got to stop the terrorists. And then I think about a couple of weeks ago when we were talking, I was giving the statistics that something like just 14% of the warrantless searches had anything to do with counterterrorism. And so why should we expect anything different when the NSA is, tapping or listening in or monitoring or whatever our phone conversations?
And I think what's really so important is to understand there is a ruling elite. What the NSA, the CIA, and all of these government agencies are doing is making sure there is no opposition to their plans for a new world order, a new world religion, and, of course, the destruction of the sovereignty of the United States. We'll be right back here in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Our guest this afternoon is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, who has taught at the university level, who's testified before Congress, who was in the Department of Education during the years of the Reagan administration, and then, of course, More recently, he has certainly dedicated himself to research. I consider him the finest researcher we have in the, going into what's going on. And we carry a number of his books, which we'll tell you about later in the program. But we were simply talking about the dog and pony show that's going on in Washington, D.C. today, where General Hayden, the four-star general, he's the Air Force general, yeah, is being considered to become the head of the CIA, and how they're saying, well, now, aren't you concerned about privacy? And the truth of the matter is, they've been spying on the American people through Project Echelon for 20 years, listening to all of your telephone calls and all of your emails. And if you doubt that, go up on the internet and punch in Echelon, E-S-C-H-A-L-O-N, that's Echelon, and you'll find out that we've given the British permission to do it, because we wouldn't want to violate the laws. So they listen to our phone calls, and we listen to their phone calls, and of course, that's all right if we listen to their phone calls. And we even have an article that James Woolsey wrote back, oh, maybe 5 or 8 years ago, talking about Echelon, and the title was, "Of course we're listening to your telephone calls." Go ahead, pick up the story there, Dennis.
Sure, in addition to Echelon, which the Europeans sort of explained to us, I mean, you didn't find this news coming from George W. Bush as to what they were up to. There's also the Iridium, or was the Iridium network of 12 satellite communication stations around the world, one of which is controlled by the Bin Laden group over in Saudi Arabia, and another one by the, I think it's called the Great Wall Corporation in China. So, you know, I mean, if you can't trust the Bin Ladens and the communist Chinese, who can you trust? Beyond that, they're doing similar to Echelon, where the British listen in and then give us information. So we can technically say that the CIA is not monitoring internally in the country. The same basic sort of information has been garnered for many years, sort of a data mining activity by private firms. So you might find an outfit like Choice Point, capital C, little H-O-I-C-E, capital P, little O-I-N-T, and you can look that up on the internet as well, a private organization that has very, very sophisticated data mining capabilities. And what they would do is, through various programs, they can, you know, find people's records, their bank records.
Hold that thought right there, please, for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Cuddy's just saying how they have all these means of tracking, and they have all these private corporations. And believe me, ladies and gentlemen, they're watching you. We live in a surveillance society, and if you don't see it, the wonderful movie they had a while ago called Enemy of the State. If you haven't seen it, probably available at Blockbuster, Will Smith, Gene Hackman, and believe me, there's a lot of truth in it. They are watching because they want no opposition to their programs. Go ahead.
Sure, and the basic point is, if you get enough information about people, you can do all sorts of things. You can project or predict what their buying habits would be, and so on. And so this data mining operation that they've had going on for a long time through private groups like Choice Point, and of course government agencies can purchase that, what you find is that they can get all kinds of records about your private transactions, whether it's financial transactions, credit, employment records, health records, you know, your purchases, your credit card, and on and on and on. And pretty soon they just have a complete dossier about you. So you know, this sort of maybe listening to see that person X calls person Y somewhere is almost sort of secondary to the information they already have on each one of us. They already have a profile on each of us. You know, I mean, it's sort of, it's not silly, but in a way, people are getting all, you know, worked up, and they should, over the NSA listening in, but they've got a ton of information on each of us already anyway, and we just sort of, you know, plod along on our normal day-to-day routine. And so what we've got is a situation where we're monitored and tracked, and you can do various things with that. At certain points, certain things could be inserted. I'm talking theoretically, not just, you know, things taken out of records. Records can be changed. All sorts of things can go on. And so this notion that you know, that Hayden is doing something new is not very valid. But anyway, Moving on to the mental health education and social control part 30. What I try to do there is show how, as you said many times, Dr. Stan, this isn't just some local isolated thing. There are international and national components to all this because the power elite has this globalist plan for our future. And one of the things that they try to use is mental health. And we've talked many times about mental health screening and how they want babies and pregnant women and all of us to have these mental health screenings. And the general impression at first was that, oh, well, they're just trying to help people with very bad psychoses. And, of course, you know, we need to be compassionate and so on. But they have a very broad definition of it. And the definition is far-reaching. In fact, it's international. And the example I give is back about 11 years ago, there was an item in the Washington Times that was titled Poor Mental Health. You know, very simple title. But what it was about was a panel of experts, international experts. It called for a UN-sponsored summit to discuss the impact of mental health on society. And what these experts did is largely sponsored by Harvard Medical School. They briefed the UN Secretary General at the time, Boutros-Ghali, and what they said in their report was that there are problems linked to mental health that threaten international stability. And so the whole thing is elevated. It's, you know, a particular person may have a mental health problem that could, in effect, make that individual a terrorist, and that could, in effect, international stability. And so it's not just, it's sort of like, you know, is the village will teach or watch out for or help the child. It's the international community. It's not just your local village, quote unquote, or community. It's now the UN and international bodies that have to assist you personally in whatever country you're in. And so since this is all elevated to the international level, the next example I give of how this could play out is the Afghan man who was recently charged with a capital crime, punishable by death, of course, when he had converted from Islam to Christianity. And there was a big hue and cry, and the Vatican got in on it, and President Bush, you know, we're very concerned, and we would tell Karzai, the leader over there, and I'm sure there were some backdoor dealings, and lo and behold, the man's life is spared, and he goes to Italy, and so forth. And everybody says, ah, sigh of relief. But the problem is, nothing had really changed. It's still a violation of the law over there in this, quote, democracy, quote, that we had liberated from the backward Taliban. And so it's still a crime for you to convert from Islam to Christianity or any other. And so what was the reason that the fellow that they gave for the fellow not being convicted? Well, they said there was this so-called lack of evidence and, quote, suspected mental illness.
In other words, he had become a Christian, suspected mental illness.
That's right. And so the larger international question then is, does anyone's conversion from Islam to Christianity cause her or him to be, quote, suspected, quote, of being, quote, mentally ill, quote? And so this, under these sort of broad definitions, now remember, the international stability, mental health could threaten, a problem with mental health could threaten international stability, right? And so you look at that, and you have this very broad definition that Alger Hiss got put into the Constitution of the World Health Organization back in the 40s, where, you know, mental illness isn't just extreme psychosis. It's your, quote, social well-being. That's the term, social well-being. And if you're going to affect international stability and you are suspected of mental illness for doing something, this all connects together. And so be very, very careful, and I predict in the future what they're going to start doing is tagging certain people with certain religious convictions as being mentally ill. And so we now have these various precedents for that. And as I say in this part 30 of my series, it's not just you know, some flaky UN thing that's going on. In this country, during the Clinton administration, one of the last things Janet Reno did was endorse a project that had been funded by her own Justice Department. And this was in February of 2000. They came out with this this National Center for Hate Crime Prevention Education Development Centers. You know, it's a long title. they published something called Responding to Hate Crime, a Multidisciplinary Curriculum for Law Enforcement and Victim Assistance Professionals. Well, the point is, this thing was funded by the U.S. Justice Department, and Janet Reno has her little okay letter in the front of it saying, you know, this is a wonderful thing. And if you actually were able to get a copy of this, and you can, it's on page 50 under what's called Offender Characteristics. It states, quote, often psychotic, suffering from mental illness that may cause hallucinations, impaired ability to reason, and withdrawal from other people, quote, and right next to that it says under motivation, that's the term motivation, states, quote, believe they have been instructed by a higher order, parentheses, God, and so forth, to rid the world of this evil. All right, so the first point is, what we have here is an offender characteristic. They're going to label you as psychotic, suffering from mental illness. You have possibly been directed to do whatever you're doing by God. And then you put those two things together with page 55, four pages later, where it explains that, quote, under, quote, hate group ideology, that such people, quote, often blame the federal government for most of this country's problems. Quote, do you know anybody like that who blames the federal government for problems? And, quote, some groups include apocalyptic Christianity in their ideology and believe we are in or approaching a period of violence and social turmoil that will precede the second coming of Christ, end quote. Do you know any people like that?
Well, I think most Christians believe that. In fact, I'll never forget, shortly after 9-1-1, I got a call from a FBI agent in Oklahoma City who asked me if I believed, in apocalyptic times, I believe in the second coming of Christ. And I said, this has always been a belief of Christianity. Christians since the beginning of time have believed in that. Sydney have asked a couple of other questions. I got thinking about it. I finally called him back, and I said, and I still remember his name very well, and I said, why did you ask me that? Is it a crime to believe that the Lord is coming again? Oh, he said, we weren't investigating you. I said, why did you ask me the question? Oh, you're not under investigation. I said, but you called me specifically to ask that question. You never heard such a frightened FBI agent.
Well, remember, the date I've just given is February of 2000.
Right, and Chris, I got a call in September of 2001.
Right, so now remember, this is a training sort of manual that goes, this particular one I got from a fellow in West Virginia. All right, but it's all over the place. And so this guy, evidently in Oklahoma or wherever, had looked at this thing and said, now let's see, mental illness. Let's see if Dr. Stan believes that there'll be that the federal government's responsible for a lot of problems, and let's see if he believes there'll be this period of violence and social turmoil that will precede the second coming of Jesus. Because if this Dr. Stan or Cuddy or whoever believes in this, he might, you know, like Jeff Foxworthy has that that show and comic routine, you might be a redneck if. Basically this guy probably said, well, Dr. Stan might be part of a hate group if, and you know, so forth and so on. He believes in the book of Revelation and whatever. And so this is a sort of pejorative labeling that's being put in place. You have to identify the potential troublemakers, potential resistors. You have to demonize them. You have to, you know, label them negatively in the eyes of the people, so that therefore you can do X, Y, and Z. And the public will say, my, you know, isn't this too bad? But given the situation, the possibility of terrorism, I guess we just have to do this. And so you condition the people. It's a conditioning process to get the public used to this. And, of course, you remember Hitler during the 1930s and the famous slogan, they came after the Jews and I did nothing. They came after the Catholics, I did nothing, and so forth and so on. And so if you label these people like that, and after the break, I'll get back to how I saw this 25 years ago in my own state.
All right, fine. We'll be back here in just a moment with Dr. Dennis. Kelly, you have to understand, there are people at the highest echelons of our government that hate Christianity. You see this in the outlawing of God and prayer from our schools, taking the nativity scenes out of public places, taking out the Ten Commandments, taking the Christ out of Christmas. And yet most Christians have no idea what's going on. Well, Dr. Cuddy, you pick up the story there.
Okay. As I said before the break, in my own state, about in the late 70s, and I'm in North Carolina, we had a he's still around, but not as governor, a very ambitious governor, James B. Hunt. And what happened in the 70s was this fellow, and there's a reason for me mentioning it. This isn't just a parochial issue. I'll get to the point as to why I'm saying this. The fellow had been a Ford Foundation fellow, and he was being groomed, and he had just been elected governor. And what we found was that he had received a communication from HEW, it was called at the time, Dr. Ursula Anderson. And I've mentioned this in a previous part, so I'll touch on this briefly, a previous part of my series of mental health education, social control. And what they said was, we want you to be a pilot project here for the whole nation. And what he came up with was what was called the Child Health Plan for Raising a New Generation, where it said the parent alone, family alone, cannot meet the needs of each new generation of people, so the state, quote, the state must step in, quote. And he had written a letter, a nurse that I knew said, well, why are you for abortion funding? And he says, because, quote, we must concentrate on raising new generations of people who are not stunted or handicapped in some way, end quote, which, you know, gives you chills down the spine hearing that mentality. So anyway, this child health plan had all kinds of bad things in it. It was almost a sort of eugenic mentality in the thing. And he said everybody would have one health care home. In other words, you know, you would have one place to report to where they could check you out for all kinds of things. And so we got all worked up about this, and we spread the word, and there was a big reaction. But the point is, what happened was Jean Young, who was Andrew Young's wife, she was head of what was called the International Year of the Child for the country. And she said, I want 50 copies of this document that Hunt had come up with to spread to all 50 states, you know, because, and then internationally, because it was International Year of the Child. And so we were able to sort of cut that off of the past because we publicized it and got a lot of local people. Less attention was paid to what he was doing also at the same time. That was called the State Health Plan. Not the Child Health, but the State Health Plan. And I got that thing. It was a big thing. And I looked in there, and two places in there, it had religion as a socioeconomic precursor of mental illness or mental retardation. And I said, whoa, I mean, you know, why are they doing that? Why are they connecting religion to mental illness and mental retardation? And, of course, we know, you know, the next Democrat who came in, what happened? That was under Jimmy Carter, and Hunt was a Democrat. And then you had Ronald Reagan, George, the first President Bush, and then when Bill Clinton comes in, you know, he has Janet Reno. And so here's the product of Reno that I've just been talking about, this document that she thought was just grand here, and how they had this definition of a hate group that could be linked to people who believed in apocalyptic Christianity, the second coming of Christ. And so, as I said, they label people, and they don't just leave it at this definition of mental illness. It's a multifaceted approach, and it's not just, I don't want to say it's just Bill Clinton, because, you know, this is not just him. What I go on to next in this part 30 is the subject of education. And I have mentioned previously how on October 3rd of 2003, U.S. Secretary of Education under George Bush, his name is Rod Paige.
Hold up, Dr. For just a moment, Dennis. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Cuddy, and we're talking about the organized effort on the part of the elite to destroy Christianity, to equate that with mental illness or potential terrorism. And so these ideas were put forward by Janet Reno, but they're there even today. And believe me, Christianity is going to come under increased persecution in the months and years that lie ahead. Because there are people at the highest levels of our government who hate Christianity and everything it stands for. Oh, they may profess to be Christians, they may say all the right things, but never judge a person by what they say. Look and see what they do, and look at the things they support, and look at the people they put into key positions who are intent upon undermining Christianity. So pick the story up.
Right, and it's important to note that they don't come after Christians in general. What they do is a sort of Delphi technique. And if your listeners aren't familiar, I'll spend just 10 seconds or so on Delphi. A Delphi technique is where you have a facilitator and they come into a group and they already have a predetermined outcome, but they don't want the members of the group to know what they're doing. What they do is try to isolate what they would call the extremists, those who want to cooperate with the others and compromise and get along and have a consensus and so on. And so they through questions identify who you are. Let's say person X, and person X is sticking by their guns on, you know, land rights or rezoning or something like that. And what they do is they separate that individual and identify the person very quickly to the others as someone who is very, very conservative. Or, I mean, it could be very, very liberal, too. It doesn't matter. But at the outlying area of philosophy on the particular issue or whatever. And so they through a process of questioning, cause the other members of the group to look at that person as a troublemaker, an extremist, you know, whatever tag you want to place on this. And so in this case, what they're doing is not attacking directly Christians and Christianity. What they're after here is those people with traditional, what they would call dogmatic or firm or moral absolutes, or a traditional biblical Christianity, or traditional Orthodox Judaism, or Islam. It doesn't matter. And what they want to do is separate those individuals from the, I guess you call them the squishy Christians or Muslims or Jews. And they're the ones they would identify as the good ones, the good Jews, the good Christians, the good Muslims. And those are people who are willing to have a consensus, you know, to compromise, to not be so judgmental, to be tolerant, you know, all of the key words they'll use. And so through this Delphi process, they would identify the individuals who are very firm in their beliefs and pit them against the others who are willing to, you know, let's look at what we all have in common rather than what divides us. And of course, in my opinion, it's not what, as a Christian, it's not what we have in common, but it's what we have that's different, that's important, the sacrificial death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. So beyond that, though, and they also use other areas such as education. And in this case, on October 3rd, I've mentioned before, October 3rd of 2003, U.S. Secretary of Education Rod Paige under George W. Bush in Paris, and Laura Bush was there as well. You know, she was just tickled to be rejoining UNESCO. That's what we were doing. And so Rod Paige remarked that, quote, "The United States is pleased to return to UNESCO. Our governments have entrusted us with the responsibility of preparing our children to become citizens of the world," end quote. And when you say that to most people, they just sort of look at you and say, well, isn't that nice, you know, something like that. And they don't appreciate what that means. He doesn't say become residents or inhabitants or whatever, citizens. If you're a citizen of the state of Texas or Pennsylvania, you have to obey the laws of Texas or Pennsylvania. So if you're going to be considered a, quote, citizen of the world, quote, then you're going to have to obey world law. That will come to have an effect on you. It will impact you. And so the ultimate goal of the globalist is to have all children of all nations think globally rather than nationally in terms of their values. And that's important. It's a value sort of thing. It's like you're in mental health, it's your Christian values that they're going to try and change. And so the example I give is that building up over the years, ever since the mid-60s, you've had something in this country called the International Baccalaureate Program. And so in that same year that Rod Paige was making that pronouncement in October, just a few months before, in June of 2003, the fellow who's the director general of that, George Walker, and the headquarters are over in Geneva, Switzerland, he said that this IB, International Baccalaureate Program, quote, remains committed to changing children's values so they think globally rather than in parochial terms from their own country's viewpoint, end quote. Now, I appreciate that. We're going to change their values so that you don't think as an American, but you think in terms of a world view.
Oh, hang on to that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Dennis Keddie. And remember, the purpose of education is not to teach our kids. It's to indoctrinate them, to change their attitude towards God and family and country. Well, Dr. Keddie, go right ahead, pick up there.
Sure. And what you had just said is key to this. In education, it's not the teaching of reading, writing, math, and what you call academic basics. They're the cognitive realm. They switched. They've been switching for a long time, but nationally they had started the switch in the early 60s, and that's why to the affective domain. If the affective means your social relationships, your feelings. And what they did by doing that is they dumbed down the population, the younger generations. But also, when you start emphasizing social relationships and feelings and so on, those involve emotions. Emotions are much more easily manipulable. Supposedly, you can't manipulate 2 + 2 = 4, although they try that as well. But we know that this was a major thrust with the students' rights movement of the 60s. You know, Johnny's trying as best he can, so we can't flunk Johnny, even though he can't add or write or anything. And so you have these social promotions. And then when he gets to high school and he's taking the SAT, of course, he doesn't score very well, right, because he doesn't know much. And so the SAT scores pretty much peaked in the early, I think it was around 1962, was the highest. Now, they try and cover this over by what's called nationally standardized tests annually. There's the California Achievement Test, Iowa Test of Basic Skills. But that really has the Lake Wobegon effect, you know, where every youngster is above average because they renorm those things every 4 or 5 years, so they take a new average, and so voila, you know, in 5 years, kids look smarter than they really are. Well, I have quotes in my book, Dr. Stan, Radio Liberty, carry the 200-year education chronology, as well as the NEA grab for power. And one of the quotes I give in there is by Catherine Barrett from the early 1970s, and she's president of the NEA. And she's saying by the year 2000, we hope to get the basics, your reading, writing, math, down to just 1/4 of the school day so that the teacher can rise to his true calling, which is to be a philosophical change agent. They want to change the values. They call them change agents. And that's what they're about, whether you call it outcome-based education or whatever. OBE is very prominent, not just Democrat. I remember when I was in Washington, D.C., with the Department of Education, Terrell Bell was Secretary of Education, and Charlotte Isabrit, was up there at the same office as I was just before me, and she got a letter from Leland Birmingham in Utah to Terrell Bell, and they said, this is our plan, we're going to put OBE into all the schools of the country. This is a great opportunity. And what you find is that the father of OBE was a William Spady, and he said there's really three types. There's traditional, transitional, and transformational.
Hold that. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Dr. Dennis Ketty, who worked in the Department of Education during the Reagan administration. And when he was there, of course, our good friend Charlotte Isabey was there as well. And they intercepted a letter from one of the people who laid it out very, very clearly. The purpose of education is to transform society. It has nothing to do with, you know, our children knowing how to read and write. This is the reason why when our kids graduate from college, most of them, when they're compared with the students from other nations, even many impoverished nations, we don't do very well. Our kids got great self-esteem, but they don't understand they're part of a social experiment, and they use education for transforming them, for transforming our society, because the last thing you want in an authoritarian society is people who can think, who can reason, who know history and realize that America was never a democracy, contrary to everything that George Bush and the leaders of both political parties tell us. We are a republic, and the purpose of government was to limit the power of government so men could be free, rather than to increase the power of government and go from war to war to war so the people can be controlled. So pick that story up from there, Dr. Cuddy.
Sure. And so the point we were at is William Spady was the father of outcome-based education as such. It had a previous name, Mastery Education, and Benjamin Bloom and some others. But Spady was the key figure over the past 20 years for OBE, as it's called. And the state that I'm in, I'm sure it's no different from others, gave him $10,000 to come in here for just 6 days to show how OBE could be instituted. And he said there were three types, traditional, which is not too much different from what you probably have in your school system now. Then there's transitional, and finally transformational. And he was very clear that transformational was about values, changing values. And so I got a paper that the fellow wrote. I think his network was called the High Success Network. And what the paper said is those conservatives that students are going to have to deal with. You know, they're the problem, this conservative ideology. And so when he's talking about values, he's talking about traditional views of most parents that have to be changed. And you have to have this sort of globalist outwork. And so, I mean, today, for the last 2 years, Spady's been over in South Africa. So this is not just a U.S. thing. So now getting back to my Part 30 in this IB program, the International Baccalaureate, the next year after that fellow, the Director General, George Walker, made his statement about what's going to change the children's values so that they no longer think as Americans or as French or as Germans and so on, but they think globally. There was a column by the Washington Times reporter for education, George Archibald, called Learning Globally. That's January 18th of 2004, and this is the quote from that. Now, see, what I want to point out is this isn't just under Clinton. This isn't just under the leftist NEA. This article says, quote, the Bush administration has begun issuing grants to help spread a UN-sponsored school program that aims to become a universal curriculum for teaching global citizenship, peace studies, and equality of world cultures. Now, remember that. Global citizenship and equality of world cultures. The goal is to devise a curriculum to teach a set of culturally neutral, universal values to which all people aspire, end quote. Now, you know, that should ring a bell. The quote goes on. And these will be based on human rights, equality of the sexes, and, quote, open-mindedness to change and obligation to environmental protection and sustainable development. The U.S. Department of Education has issued its first $1.2 million grant to implement the European-based IB program in middle schools. An IB regulation accepted by participating American schools requires that all tests and written papers of American students sent to Europe for grading and evaluation become the absolute property of the International Baccalaureate Organization in Geneva, end quote. So here we have, we've bumped this thing up to the international level. It's not just that the UN has an idea and says, you know, might you want to try this. The papers, the American students' papers, actually are sent to Geneva. They're graded in Geneva. They're the property of the IB organization in Geneva. And you have to have this change in values so that you're not really thinking as an American, what's best for America, what's best for American citizens. You have to have this global perspective so that, let's say there's some American values or American policy, American viewpoint that conflicts with the, quote, the globalist view. You're supposed to junk that American view. You're supposed to junk that view of what you believe is best as an American and say, no, no, I reject that. I take this other view. This global view. And so that's in terms of education. And then the final part of the Part 30 that I did, of course, is about social control. And what one of the things that the paralegal wants to do is, quote, eliminate, quote, the barely educated, unhealthy, and poor segment of our country. Now, as soon as you hear that, say, my goodness, what are you saying, Dr. Cuddy? You're saying that these people should be eliminated? That's surely no one is for that. Maybe, you know, let's have birth control or something, but not eliminate. Well, if you think that's an extreme example, you need to consider the fact that that is exactly what Ron Weddington wrote to Bill Clinton. Now, who's he? Who's Weddington? He was co-counsel with his wife, Sarah Weddington, in the infamous Roe versus Wade case that came before the Supreme Court in 1973. And in January of 1993, this is the point at which he is writing this letter to Betsy Wright of Bill Clinton's presidential transition team. Clinton's been elected, but he hasn't come into office yet. This is January 6th. It'll be a few days, so it's a transition period. And he's writing to Betsy Wright of the transition team. And he says that he, Ron Weddington, and his wife, Sarah, are discussing setting up a non-profit organization to license and distribute the abortifacient RU-486 pill. And he says to Betsy Wright, he says, I'm enclosing with this letter a Dear President-to-be Clinton letter. And he does. Yeah, I've got a copy of it. In which Ron Weddington states, quote, you can start immediately to eliminate, see that word, eliminate the barely educated, unhealthy, and poor segment of our country. The problem is that their numbers are not only replaced, but increased by the birth of millions of babies to people who cannot afford to have babies. He goes on and says, there, I've said it. It's what we all know is true, but we only whisper it. Government is also going to have to provide vasectomies, tubal ligations, and abortions, RU 486, and conventional abortions. You could do it, Mr. President-to-be. You are articulate, and you've already alienated the religious right with your positions on abortion and homosexuals. The middle-class taxpayer will go along with this plan because it will mean fewer dollars for welfare. The retirees will also go along because poor people contribute very little to Social Security. And he concludes by saying, we don't need more poor babies, end quote. And so if you have any knowledge of history, you know that these are the exact sentiments of Planned Parenthood founder Margaret Sanger and her eugenic philosophy. And so it's alive and well as we speak. And here's a letter being presented to President Clinton to that effect.
And, of course, there really is a racist attitude out there. We see an AIDS epidemic. Isn't it interesting that it primarily targets blacks, both here in the United States and Africa? I wonder why that would be, especially if you've read Margaret Sanger's attitudes towards blacks. And, of course, this was also the attitude of the Nazis. Certainly Adolf Hitler almost had an apoplectic seizure when, during the Olympics that were held in Berlin, black defeated the German athletes.
Jesse Owens.
So you have to really understand, it's so difficult for people to understand. There really are people who have no human compassion. Certainly Jacques Cousteau's famous remark about the necessity of eliminating 365,000 people a day. We have his article where he's quoted in the UNESCO Courier of 1991, November of 1991. And certainly blacks have been targeted here in the United States and throughout the world with certain diseases. And of course, isn't it amazing that, you know, in a country like Botswana, the latest figures show 46% of the pregnant women, the pregnant black women who come in to be tested before they're going to have a child, 46% are HIV positive and they're going to die. Either that is a terribly failed public health policy or a very successful genocidal policy. If it was a failed public health policy, you would think that they would change the policy. But they're not going to. They continue doing just what they've done always in the past. So there really is are people who look at the world differently than you and I do. Isn't that true, Dr. Cuddy?
Oh, absolutely. In case the elite, let's say Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller, the first of the Rockefellers, the Standard Oil man, he's the one who actually introduced Margaret Sanger, Planned Parenthood founder, to the big money people and really got her going to found Planned Parenthood. She had the Birth Control League at first and later it basically changed its name to Planned Parenthood. But they had a terrific program. I mean, eugenics, they had an international eugenics congress back in 1912 and, you know, Winston Churchill was there and Charles Eliot, head of Harvard, and all the big names were showing up at this. It was a standard process. Woodrow Wilson, as I said, he was they had a eugenic mentality at that time. And during the 20s, to mention blacks, they not only had what she called, Margaret Sanger, this sort of baby code as to, you know, who was desirable and who was not, but they actually had a Negro, they called it at the time Negro Project, and she would hire black ministers to go out and assuage the concerns of the black population as in case they might get the idea that they were going to try to eliminate them, of course, which they were. But it wasn't just for them. I mean, she said, we got to get rid of all the, she called them dysgenic, D-Y-S-G-E-N-I-C, dysgenic stocks. And by just dysgenic stocks, she meant, you know, not only blacks, she meant Catholics and gypsies and Jews and all of these inferior types. She felt, according to her, had to be reduced or eliminated as much as possible. And I remember I've got a letter signed by Margaret Sanger. She later on changed her name. She married more than once to Slee, S-L-E-E. And it's dated. She's over in, I think it's Tucson, Arizona, is the place where she's writing from, and I got this letter from her, and she's writing to H.G. Wells, and he's just come out with this book. It has a sort of Latin title. It's anti-Catholic. And she said, "Oh, H.G., who was one of her lovers, actually." She said, "Oh, H.G., this is a wonderful book you've gotten." She said, "I don't know why the White House in Washington is so timid about going after these Catholics. I mean, Cordell Hull is under the thumb of this Catholic man." I mean, she's going on like this. "Under the thumb of this Catholic man, and, you know, and congratulations, I'm so glad that you've taken a shot at the Catholic Church." And so anyway, there's an anti-Semitic element to this, anti-Catholic, let's get rid of the blacks attitude on the part of people like Sanger. And that transfers on. I mean, in the 40s, when she's writing this letter, is when Alger Hiss has this constitution of the World Health Organization formed, and later on I've got quotes by a Bishop Derry, D-E-R-Y, 20 years ago, and he's over in Ghana, and he's talking very freely. He says, "We're under pressure from the World Health Organization and others, World Bank and so forth, tremendous international pressure to change our policy regarding, especially through money, like the World Bank, you change your program of fertility to limit population." He says, "We're resisting now abortions. We're resisting all of this stuff. But who knows how long we can, because, you know, they won't give us loans to our government unless we change our social and medical and abortion policy and things like that." So the World Health Organization is out there doing all of this sort of thing. In fact, when Kissinger was under Nixon, they developed in 1973 what's called this NSSM, it's the National Security Staff Memorandum 200, which lays out a plan for all countries. I mean, it's not just Africa. It's every country has to limit its population, or you won't get the loans for food and, you know, financial assistance or aid to have food brought to your impoverished people. And that was approved by Brent Scowcroft. So Kissinger developed it, and then Brent Scowcroft gives it his okie-dokie. And so that was the policy for every country, all over the world. Our foreign aid was based on that. And in this country, it translated not only to a sort of eugenic policy by Margaret Sanger in the 30s, and FDR also wrote a letter to some people about Hispanics, you know, Puerto Ricans. He said, "You'll hear this little whir sound," he made this sound, and say, "Ah, you know, zap, you're sterile, ha-ha," and they didn't laugh about it. And so there was this attitude about Hispanics and blacks and Catholics and Jews and gypsies and the whole bit. And so this translates really into sort of a public policy. In the 1960s, I remember there was this district attorney, Ellen Morfonius was her name. She later became a judge. She was originally from the state I'm in, North Carolina, but at the time she was down in Florida. She was like a district attorney. And she got a hold of something called Project READ, R-E-A-D. And it was funded by Carnegie. It was by one of these behavioral institutes out in Stanford, I think. But it funded by Carnegie. And this was teaching inner city poor black youngsters how to read. And it wasn't just, you know, phonics and will, you know, cats, cat like that. But it taught them by picture, visual images, sort of a look-say method, not phonics. And the way it would do it is, if you want to teach a child the word porch, P as in Peter, O-R-C-H, you show the picture of a little black boy, and he'd have a torch, T as in Thomas, O-R-C-H, and he'd be setting the porch on fire with his torch. Now, I could think of a thousand ways to teach a child porch without having him set a porch on fire. But that's the type of thing they had in these books. And so, lo and behold, Shirley Carell, who's down there, she's deceased now, head of Pro Family Forum, she says it wasn't long after that. You know, a few years after that, these elementary kids would have, you know, 10 years later, and all of a sudden, strange as it may not seem, you had all of these fires. I mean, they'd be burning, you know, police cars and all of these things in these inner cities. And everybody scratched their head, "Wow, I wonder where this came from." Well, they teach these youngsters this sort of thing. Same thing I found out when I was with the federal government up in Washington. They had, and I put this little graph in a letter that was that I sent and had published in the Washington Post. They were, you know, scratching their heads over this suicide rate. My goodness. Look at this youth suicide rate of these teens. Why are these teens committing all this suicide? You know, the graph was going up, up, up. And so what I did was I said, well, maybe it's what you're teaching here. And I showed in the Maryland, which is right next door to Washington's elementary schools, whether it's Prince George's County or, you know, Baltimore, wherever, Montgomery County, they've been teaching all these elementary school youngsters, you know, a few years before, songs like the theme song from MASH. which is really titled Suicide is Painless, that theme you all know, da-da-da-da-da, like that. That's really Suicide is Painless are the words, and the youngsters were being taught the words, saying the game of life is lost anyway, and suicide is painless. So what do you expect?
Unfortunately, they give many of the young people the feeling that, you know, life is simply quiet desperation. No good deed will ever go unpunished. And, hey, you know, life is tough, and then you die. And then we wonder why some of the young people take their own lives. Well, Dr. Dennis Kelly, thank you so very much for being with us. And we look forward to having you on again here next week.
Thanks for having me.
God bless. Bye-bye. And, of course, we'll tell you a little more about how you can get hold of Dr.
Kelly's books.
And, of course, many of them are available right here at Radio Liberty. His Timeline for Education for the New World Order. His book, Cover Up, September 11th, Prior Knowledge. Road to Socialism. Mental health screening, and so much more, available from Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we were simply mentioning some of the books that Dr. Cuddy has actually written, and we do carry a number of them here, and right now we do carry his book, September 11th, Prior Knowledge, his book, Cover Up, his book, Road to Socialism. And, of course, there is a Fabian socialist movement. It controls the British Labour Party. It works at the highest levels of both the Democratic and Republican Party. And these people are dedicated to world socialism. And when you understand this has nothing to do with redistribution of the wealth of the wealthy, it has to do with redistribution of the wealth of the middle class and, of course, establishing a new ruling or feudal system, a feudal elite who will rule the world. That's what socialism is really all about. So contrary to everything that most socialists believe, they really have never read H.G. Wells' wonderful book, An Experiment in Autobiography, where he tells about a group called the Coefficients. And H.G. Wells, of course, was a founding member of the Fabian Socialist Society back in the 1980s. Pardon me, the 1880s, but by the early 1900s, and we're talking about from 1903 to about 1909, why the leaders of Fabian Socialism, George Bernard Shaw, Bertrand Russell, Sidney and Beatrice Webb, H.G. Wells and the others, met regularly with the leaders of the British financial elite, Lord Cecil, Lord Grey, Lord Milner, and all of the others, to plan on how they were going to take over the world. Because, you see, socialists have always worked with people of great wealth. You can read about this in H.G. Wells' book, An Experiment in Autobiography, in his book, The Open Conspiracy. In his book, he doesn't get so much into that in the book, The New World Order, which was published, I think, in the 1930s or 1940s. But, of course, he gets into the plan for the world government, and that has always been the goal of the ruling elite. They want to rule the world. But, of course, H.G. Wells and most of the other people who were involved never understood the spiritual force that motivated most of them. A few of them may have, and a few of them may have recognized that they were serving a different God, but so many of the people found that as long as they went around with the system, they were always successful. They had the praise of the mass media. And, of course, they would have tremendous access to power and wealth and drugs and sex. And you name it, you give your soul to the dark side, and you'll be well and taken care of. And if you doubt that, you need to get the videos we carry. They sold their souls for rock and roll. They sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version. And I promise you, after you've seen those videos, you'll never look the world the same way, eyes again. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we're really dependent upon those of you who listen to our programs to help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day on radio, on the Internet, 4 hours a day on shortwave, 9 hours a day on satellite, although some of those programs are rebroadcast. But that's on Telstar 5, and we encourage you to get your friends to listen to that 24 hours a day conservative Christian programming. Our answer to Howard Stern, but it's an expensive proposition, and we need your help to continue doing that. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family for a suggested gift of $20 a month or more, you get our 4 best tapes or CDs of the month. You'll get our monthly newsletter, but more than that, you'll be helping finance what we do. We're on 60 different radio and internet outlets. We're reaching people not only all across America, but all across the world with an understanding of the fact we're involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Western civilization. And certainly, if you would like to know more, you need to get some of the books we carry. A book written by Professor Carol Quigley, Bill Clinton's mentor, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. A book that was so good that shortly after it was published in 1966, somebody came and bought up the publisher, Macmillan, and destroyed the place to the first half of the book. And for years, this book was not available. If you doubt that story, we have an interview with Professor Carol Quigley where he tells that story. It's in our four-tape set, The Secret Government, and you can get that as part of the four-tape set or as part of the Tragedy and Hope special, which includes the book Tragedy and Hope, the book Foundations, Their Power and Influence, and the two-hour interview with Professor Quigley, which was done not by me, but I purchased the right to use the tapes from Professor Quigley's widow. And then, of course, we have my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, which begins to tie everything together because although Professor Quigley was far more brilliant than I would ever hope to be, he never understood what he'd uncovered. He uncovered this vast conspiracy of people of great wealth working for world government, but he never recognized the spiritual component behind this whole thing. He had all the facts, and he missed the forest for the trees. So behind all of it, these things going on today are powerful spiritual forces that have been working literally for thousands of years to bring us to right where we are today. As we move here in America into a period of chaos and crisis on the international field, into war in the Middle East, and I really feel we're moving rapidly towards the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. Why did we attack Iraq? Why? So we could be there, so we could attack Iran. And, of course, the attack on Iran will inflame the entire Islamic world and, of course, plunge, I fear, not only the Middle East, but right here in America into terrible, terrible suffering. I was in Germany following the Second World War. I saw the cities in rubble. I shudder at the thought it could happen here, but why wouldn't it happen here? God is just... Do you think he's going to allow us to continue living the affluent life when we've had so much and we've turned against him? We've repudiated God. We've taken him out of our classrooms. We've taken him out of our schools. We're even changing the message and the music of the Christian church. And, of course, adopting so many of the occult practices right within our churches today. And if you doubt that, you really need to get our materials, so much of it on the supernatural, some of the books we carry, Who's Driving the Purpose-Driven Church, or books by Warren Smith, Deceived on Purpose. You need to get our material. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Go to our webpage at RadioLiberty.com. Read the material that's there. Look at the videos, the tape sets, the books we have available. And then please pray for America. Pray for revival, because if we don't have a great revival, we're going to lose America. And our cities will resemble those of Germany after the Second World War. And then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until Monday, may the Lord be with you.